Welcome to This Week in Private Markets, a podcast by TAP. We give investors, allocators, advisors, and others a weekly digest that keeps you in the know about the news in private markets. Please see the show notes for relevant disclaimers. This is the week of December 10th, and this is what we at TAP saw in private markets. We'll start by running through a few big deals of the week. Arkhouse Management, Brigade Capital, together submitted a proposal to acquire the retailer Macy's for $5.8 billion. ARA Partners closed over $3 billion of new capital commitments to invest in industrial decarbonization. Sandbrook Capital raised $2.1 billion to back climate infrastructure deals. And Oaktree raised about $3 billion for its latest special situations fund. With that, let's get into the main stories of the week. Of course, the main thing, Dow, NASDAQ, S&P, all closing at record highs as the Fed has signaled somewhat of a dovish pivot. Basically, the Federal Reserve Committee acknowledged that inflation has eased. They somewhat implied that the rate tightening cycle might be over. And they also published their dot plot, which forecasts how they think rates will evolve over the coming year. And that hinted at lower borrowing costs in the future. What do you guys make of all this?
Well, whatever the Fed actually said, the market certainly heard. We're done with rate hikes and rates are coming down.
One of the few people who actually watched the meeting over lunch yesterday, I can say that it was pretty dovish. Like the both the minutes and the comments afterwards, nothing really leaned towards anything hawkish. So obviously means that behind the scenes they've seen the inflation data coming and trending down. Specifically, you know, there's this way they measure. It's about 35% of the inflation basket is rent or real estate. You know, your cost of living and shelter, and that is done on a lag. And so I think they're seeing that come down a lot in their data, and they can pretty much programmatically project out that it will go down over time. It seems like they're pretty dovish based off of that.
Yeah, I mean, have they done it? Can I say soft landing, or is it too early? I mean,
you know what? It felt like Powell was a bit giddy in this thing. I mean, he was about to grab the mic and be like, "I did it! I did it!"
Yeah, the world's best central banker.
Oh, everyone was talking about, you know, it's as hard as landing a jet airliner on a post-it note to do a soft landing or whatever. Well, here we are. We got our ace pilot in the seat.
Yeah, I mean, look, jobs growth still strong. I think still around 200,000 or so jobs being created monthly.
The unemployment rate is at, 3.5% or somewhere in that ballpark. Right.
And then labor participation rate is up at the same time. That's obviously, good when that goes up and unemployment goes down. And, you're still seeing strong consumer spending even through the end of November. You would obviously expect that to stay really strong in December. So I don't know. Everything's pointing to a pretty rosy picture overall.
Yeah, I mean, enough of this week in public markets. We should talk a little bit about private markets, though. So, I mean, what do we think the impact? We've obviously seen the impact directly in public markets. You see it instantly. The Dow has breached 37,000 for the first time. But what do we think the impact on private markets is, which is something that we kind of detect more in our conversations and over a longer time frame. So it's more of a projection, because this is going to take weeks, months, and even quarters to play out about how these types of moves impact private markets.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I don't think we're going to see real impacts to, quarterly valuation levels. I don't necessarily think we'll see real impacts, and maybe we'll cover this later on in this episode, but real impact to, how much capital is being deployed, how it's being deployed. The private sector, or the private markets rather, will lag certainly. But regardless, you can't help, I think, if you are, a private equity fund manager, you can't help but crack a smile here. Knowing that hopefully, the pain is ending here in the next couple quarters for you, potentially, you'll be able to kind of finance your buyouts, more cheaply. You'll be facing kind of less scrutiny on your quarterly fund marks. So there will be a lag, but, hopefully both private and public markets, are going to have a pretty good 2024, at least compared to how 2023 and 2022 have been.
So let's throw another data point in the mix here, which is that according to a report from BlackRock, the private capital industry has $4 trillion of dry powder, which is massive in and of itself, but also a massive percentage actually of the overall capital in private markets. So kind of Adam, to what you were just saying, is the industry gearing up to plow massive amounts of capital into everything that comes across their desk, or does it mean that they're actually being really cautious despite what's going on in public markets?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this $4 trillion number is because they have been cautious, but also, you know, there probably haven't been that many great deals out there for them to deploy capital into. So, you know, we've seen this build up to $4 trillion.
You know what? I mean, think about it. What was everyone doing last year and partially this year? Everyone's waiting for the shoe to drop, right? Everyone's waiting for the recession. So you keep thinking the prices are going to get better. I got to hold on to my dry powder because the prices are going to get better. And you missed buying the dip. You know, that's what the story has been, whether it's since 2009, whether it's COVID or this situation here, there wasn't as much of a dip as you expected to buy.
No, I mean, there really wasn't at all. I mean, I think technically now what the Dow's been in a bull market for a year, right? Meeting the technical definition or the most common definition. So no, I mean, clearly people did not take advantage of the dip if this really is going to be the trend, you know, into 2024. But look, I think people will start deploying more aggressively. I think there will still be caution. I mean, there are a ton of, you know, macro and geopolitical risks in particular still out there. But it's certainly a bit of a sigh of relief. And, you know, hopefully that dry powder figure starts to come down a bit and, you know, investors can, you know, actually start getting their money's worth from the management fees they've been paying the last couple of years.
All that is liquidity that comes on board, right? Like this is money that can be deployed into the market. And, you know, and another way to look at this dry powder too is that there's a ton of money sitting in money market funds right now. There's about $6 trillion that are in money market funds because the Fed has been raising the short-term rates. So everyone has parked their cash into these 5% paying short-term money market funds. I think about 2.2 trillion of it, approximately a little over that is retail investors. 3.5 trillion of it is institutional investors. And that stuff has to come off the sidelines. Now, obviously, there's a lot of sort of like overlap between these because a lot of that quote unquote dry powder is actually held in cash instruments by these institutional investors. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see how much money there is that's sort of going to be deployed out into the market when people decide that, oh, it's a bull market and I'm not waiting for the other shoe to drop. And instead, you better get in before it's too late, right? When the storyline reverses itself, that's when you'll see all this come in. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, of course, because whenever you think that everyone else has reversed their thinking about the market, you want to be the first one to act and get in there. So there's a dynamic when a market shifts from bear to bull that starts to kick in and changes things. And I mean, I think that the feeling from this week, particularly from the FOMC minutes and the way the market has behaved, feels like this isn't the last gasp of, well, this feels like it is kind of like a shift in the terminology that everyone is using about the market. As are we in a bear market, are we in a bull market? And people are talking about it as if we're in a bull market, not a bear market now.
Yeah, it's amazing how things can really change, you know, from one week to the other here. Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. You know, you wonder, is this coming too soon? Is all this capital going to start flooding, you know, various asset classes, and we're going to see, you know, asset bubble inflation?
Why is there all this capital? There's all this capital because they printed so much. You know, they printed all this money that we have sitting in all these accounts here. And that's what's going to come on board and come online. They've been holding it back by raising the rates. They try to take liquidity out of the system with monetary policy by raising the rates. But if the rates come down, it'll punch it back in. So I don't think we're done with inflation yet. What we're all certain of is that we're done with 9% inflation. And we kind of should have known that before. The 9% was transitory. The 3% might not be.
Let's move on to the next topic. Well, we've got a bull market here in the US. Things aren't looking quite so rosy in China, where, you know, obviously there have been a number of challenges to deploying capital. But the country's securities regulators seem determined to put up a few more hurdles. So they recently introduced a new set of draft rules that would require qualified investors in PE and VC funds to put up a minimum that is three times as high as the previous thresholds. So quite a substantial increase here, particularly aimed, I think, from their perspective at protecting small investors and private funds.
That amount is only about $500,000, though, by the way, which you know, is a lot more in yuan, but still, like, it's not like, yeah, 3x, it's not insane, but supposedly enough to dramatically, you know, cut down on the amount of individual investor activity inside of this. And the other thing is they added a rule that makes a much larger amount. I think it's like 10 million yuan or something like that to invest in deal by deal things. So basically what they really heard is folks who are syndicating out to high net worths, you know, deal by deal type of investments. That seems like what they're most worried about in terms of there being sort of issues with, you know, the propriety of the type of investments they're making.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would ask though, you know, what, and maybe we'll never know this, I mean, it is China. I mean, what's really kind of prompting this? I mean, have there been massive cases of, you know, fraud or high net worth individuals just getting absolutely roasted in these types of investments? I guess I'm curious what's really driving this. It doesn't seem like it's a policy maneuver that's necessarily been based in any kind of, you know, negative impact that's actually happened on these types of investors. And we also don't really know how these early stage funds, for example, really are funded. You know, a high net worth individual, you know, probably means something very, very different in China than it might in the United States. And so I don't know, it's a little murky to me what the data really behind this is. You know, honestly, it's hard to kind of separate the politics from this. This seems to just be another political move potentially to control, frankly, you know, private actors in the Chinese economy. And, you know, anyway, I would be curious to kind of understand the justification for this. And I don't think any of that has really come out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did see that one of the people interviewed here was saying that he expects that, you know, tons of private funds would go out of business. He specifically said at least 1,000, which, you know, probably he's talking his own book there. But obviously, one thing that does do is when you kind of take out some of the smaller players, it just makes it easier to regulate the bigger players, right? The bigger players are just easier to keep track of, easier to keep tabs on. And so, you know, maybe that's one of the effects of it. I don't know. I mean, like you were saying, we don't have the inside scoop here on what's going on inside of these agencies that are doing this. But we do know that, you know, that it's not a good sign considering the other stuff that we've seen come out of China that, like, there hasn't been a fund raised this year that is China focused, like a PE fund, a buyout fund that's China focused. There hasn't been one raised this year. And I think the overall investment into Chinese PE funds themselves is down about 90% since 2021. And it's down, you know, I think 30% or something like that since last year. So, you know, exactly. Another thing that's kind of choking off capital to the region.
Exactly. Which, you know, at this point, given the economic troubles, the fact that the market's been much weaker there generally, and this kind of tightening grip over both the private sector and now, you know, private capital raising, I mean, it just seems like the pendulum has really swung in favor of control, right? Much more control versus, you know, encouraging, you know, private investment or, you know, economic development in other ways.
It's possibly a decoupling thing too. I mean, we're speculating now, but it's possibly a decoupling thing where, you know, you don't want to be dependent on oil from the rest of the world if you're concerned about potentially getting sanctioned in the case of conflict, and you don't want to be dependent on capital from the rest of the world. And the more sort of tie-ins that you have, because I think a lot of this rule particularly, I think they were saying, was going to impact, you know, sort of international angel investors, you know, and in institutional international investors as well that might come over and put sort of smaller dollars to work, and just having like less tie-ins between the two.
You're also, you know, you're really impacting those voices abroad that may not be entirely right. Consistent with internal policy, right?
Interesting stuff. I have a feeling we'll be covering this again in the future. But for now, let's move on. Color Capital came out with a new report from a survey they did of LPs. And Jeff, want to walk us through some of the highlights that you saw?
you're correspondent on the scene. Yeah, so look, I read this report. It comes from Color Capital, you know, the very large Marquee Secondaries fund out of London. It's a survey of 110 LPs. These are pretty large LPs. They control collectively about $2.2 trillion in capital. I'm just going to list out a couple of the highlights here that are sort of surprising, the things that stuck out to you. Now, obviously, we're seeing things where, you know, people are bullish on private credit and, you know, there's, you know, returns are between 11 and 12, 20%. These are normal things, but I'm going to call out a couple of things that maybe don't go with some of the traditional narratives or a little bit stand out. So the first one that I thought was interesting was their orientation towards this new regulation, the new fund rules that came out. And while the sort of private equity industry generally has been very bearish in the rules, and we've covered this on the program before around the lawsuits and things against the SEC for these rules, the LPs in this report were very bullish, were very favorable viewpoint of the of these rules. And so across the board, across pretty much all the main provisions, there was about 80% agreement with that it was a welcome provision. And so I think the lowest one was about 76% of LPs approved of the side letter rules and the implementation of the side letter rules. And the high watermark was, I think, about in the mid 80s, I think about 86% of folks approved of the GP clawback rules. And then all the other things in between were about 80%. So really, you know, counter to what we've seen from the rest of the private equity industry is that LPs actually very much like this regulation that has come out by and large.
Yeah, most LPs, I'm sure, you know, the ones benefiting from the side letters or, you know,
Look, these are the largest LPs in the world that we're talking about here, though, man. 110 controlling $2 trillion worth of capital. These are pretty large LPs.
So I guess the largest of the largest might not like it.
It truly was. I mean, if you wanted to carve it up in a certain way, it truly was the SEC pre-negotiating some things, some rules on behalf of the LPs in relation to the GPs. And so I think that's the cut on it would take that comes out of this. The GPs have a little bit larger voices in the market generally.
LPs money, right? It makes sense. So the LPs, yeah, I mean, you know, we should prioritize that. But anyway, Sorry.
And the you know, please comment. The second thing out of here was the stance on venture capital. So it was bearish, but I thought a lot of folks would, you know, be overall, you know, think venture capital was going to bounce back. But about one third thought it would bounce back in 1 to 2 years, which is less than I thought. Only 1% thought it would bounce back in the next year. So people are generally negative on venture capital, which I guess isn't too surprising considering some of the other stuff that we've covered on this program.
Yeah. Again, though, I challenge, like, what does bounce back really mean? I mean, what are we bouncing back to?
You know, bounce back, and that's probably maybe a problem with the question construction. You know, I think the word that they used was recover. And does recover mean 2021? I think not. But
hopefully we never recover to that, you know, madness. But yeah, look, it's a question with a relative, you know, viewpoint, obviously. So
okay, and then the last one here is that only 32% think that private wealth will be a big part of the private wealth and retail and all that will be a big part of the capital base for the foreseeable future. So that you know, there's a lot of folks who are kind of not that bullish on, you know, private wealth managers being a big part of private markets in the future.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's certainly counter to the narrative we've been hearing from many of these managers who've, you know, started, you know, whole teams, right, to raise money.
Got it. If you look at the sample that we're looking at here, these are very, very large LPs. So perhaps their idea of what a significant part of the capital base is a little bit different considering they can $2.2 trillion in assets overall themselves. So, you know. Maybe they have a little bit of a different viewpoint than others who are more on the front lines of dealing with wealth managers and more retail type investors.
Right. It's a funding gap. It's not meant to be a replacement for the traditional institutional LP market. That's for sure.
Not very good stuff. Thanks for walking us through some of the highlights. Let's move on to the world of sports, specifically to the German Soccer League. Now, a number of private equity firms such as Advent, Blackstone, CVC, EQT have submitted offers to buy up to 10% in a new entity that would control the commercial rights, basically, of the top two tiers of German soccer. And on Monday, the league, the clubs in the league basically decided that they want to go ahead with a deal and pick a potential partner. And in doing this, the Football League is looking to raise up to $1 billion. And they basically want to use that to increase the broadcast production and increase the value of their international media rights and kind of bring it more in line with what they've seen from their peers in the UK, for example.
Well, I'm just disappointed that at no point in that did you speak German, Thomas. I wanted you to say Deutsche Fußballliga or something like that at some point, considering you can speak German. But
you nailed it.
My accent's
we'll just get Jeff to speak all the German.
Yeah, he can do it. He clearly can.
Yeah, I mean, the sport in Germany, I feel like, is always, I don't know if suffered from is the right word, but they've certainly not benefited from, you know, sort of two aspects that other leagues have. You know, one is obviously I think there's a rule where I think you can't have more than, you know, majority ownership by professional investors, which obviously cuts out a lot of the large sovereign wealth funds and a lot of the professional or institutional investors that have put money into other leagues and other teams. And the other point is the one we're discussing here, right? I think they've never really extracted any value from their broadcast rights by letting in this kind of private capital. So, you know, and look, unsurprisingly, you know, they are much, you know, the Bundesliga and other, you know, leagues in Germany are obviously much less well-known globally. And, you know, you also don't, frankly, have the same competitive nature of the league, right? I mean, I think, you know, you have one or two teams sitting at the top, and it is pretty hard for teams further down the table to do well. So obviously having many good teams like you do in England also raises the profile of the game. So, you know, I think they're catching up with their peers by bringing in private capital to extract more value from their broadcast rights, obviously improve their international recognition. I think the next move would be to loosen up some of these restrictions to bring in more private capital that could start actually assisting some of these teams, you know, that financially have been weaker, historically have had weaker performance. And hopefully the whole league here could be elevated by bringing more private capital in and, you know, obviously create a lot of value for everyone.
I mean, this is the third time that private capital has tried to come in and it finally got in there for a small portion of it. So very far cry. But I mean, it seems like some folks see promise. I mean, we have some of the biggest private equity firms, Advent, Blackstone, CVC, EQT, putting a bid in on this. So they must see either these, you know, the broadcast rights are, you know, hopelessly undervalued, right? They have to take advantage of them so far. And or perhaps that there's some bigger future here to increase that stake and really change the way that the league monetizes and how much it's worth overall. And they want a kind of a foothold in it. But it seems like there's like a list of marquee big players who are wanting to play in this market.
I mean, if I'm just doing some very basic math here, you know, they're investing to get up to 10% of this new entity, and they're hoping to raise or invest $1 billion, which would value the overall entity at $10 billion to me. And maybe there's sort of a little bit of a patriot coming out in me, but that feels incredibly low.
Yeah, I mean, look, for how much talent, you know, the league produces, for how much sort of fame and success the German national team has had historically, right? The whole league does feel very undervalued. I would totally agree with that. So, I mean, this is this is an incremental step, hopefully in the right direction. And, you know, perhaps we'll see them competing, you know, with the English Premier League or other leagues, you know, around the continent.
Fantastic. Very good. Let's move on to our last story for the week here. Private equity owners are growing a bit tired of backing their portfolio companies in some cases. So whether it's due to higher interest rates or other macro factors, basically there's some data out there to suggest that PE firms are getting tired of sort of, you know, one capital infusion after the other, and they want out. As a result, the number of private firms that are being handed over to private lenders in debt for equity swaps, for example, has reached the highest level since 2009. Adam, since you're our sort of resident debt guy, what do you think? Is the situation dire? Is this an indicator that PE firms are getting tired of sponsoring their companies and want out?
I mean, certainly some companies, yeah, but I mean, this has always happened, right? I mean, I think at some point, you know, the equity is so far out of the money in a lot of these companies that it's the right move for the manager to step away and hand the keys over, right? And I think that's what you need to do to sort of fulfill your fiduciary duty. And not sort of continue to throw, you know, good money after bad necessarily. I mean, I think two things have happened, you know, two trends basically since 2009, but, you know, definitely more recently. And that's why you're seeing this kind of debt for equity swap, you know, perhaps be more common now than previously. You know, one change is obviously it's become a lot more expensive to keep these companies alive. You know, I mean, we talked about interest rates coming down perhaps next year, but they're obviously higher than they were, you know, a few years ago. So that is an expense and perhaps a more recent trend. But the other one is really, you know, who your lenders are. You know, you go back 10, 15 years, it was primarily commercial banks, right? They're not operators. They have no idea how to make widgets or whatever the company does, right? They don't want to own the company. So they're willing to restructure in a way that probably keeps them from having to take the keys. Now, I mean, you have all of these distressed debt funds, other types of credit funds, direct lenders who really are kind of private equity style operators, right? And there's a whole industry that's developed around buying debt cheap, hoping the company frankly fails and needs to restructure, and you end up owning all of the equity and having a completely unlevered balance sheet, right? So, you know, I think those two trends are coming together, and that's why we are seeing more debt for equity swaps. I don't necessarily think this is some kind of a negative prognosis on the industry or where the economy is going, but, you know, certainly these trends are different. And now, look, some of these are probably great companies. Delever the balance sheet, you know, give them new ownership, and, you know, they should have a chance, you know, a second chance, or probably for some of these, it's a third, fourth, or a fifth, you know, bite at the apple at this point. But that's, you know, that's the whole point of kind of bankruptcy law here in the US, right? To kind of give you a clean slate.
Seems like a secular shift since 2008, and something that we should expect more of as we see greater and greater penetration of private credit and different private credit strategies into the market. The cyclical part of this where, oh, our default's rising again. I mean, I don't see any data. I don't see really data that's sort of suggesting that we're on some like big rising default path right now. You know, if you look, there was a bunch of defaults in 2020, but it's not like it's back at those levels. It's pretty much at historical averages. So
yeah, default rates can, you know, tick up ever so slightly and lead to dozens and dozens of these types of restructurings, right? So it doesn't necessarily signal anything. I mean, the word on the street certainly is that there are a lot of these sort of debtor side, you know, bankruptcy mandates out there for bankers to pitch right now. So, I mean, even anecdotally, you know, we are certainly hearing that there's just a lot of these big restructurings happening. So, you know, I think it's something normal, and, you know, it'll run its course. But I agree with you, Jeff, you know, more private credit in these types of businesses, you know, will inevitably lead to more of these large balance sheet restructurings, not sort of, more cosmetic, you know, kind of changes to the balance sheet when perhaps commercial banks were your primary lenders.
Very good. Let's wrap it up here. There's been another great episode of This Week in Private Markets. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.